Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
About a month ago, we aired an interview with Professor Rodney Stark, co-founder and co-director of Baylor Institutes for Studies of Religion, regarding his most recent book, The Triumph of Christianity, How the Jesus Movement Became the World's Largest Religion. The expansive nature of that book, examining the history of Christianity from just before its beginnings until present day, made it impossible to cover all the findings in our usual one-hour format. Indeed, we were only able to cover the first three centuries, examining topics such as the socioeconomic demographics of Christian converts and the role that martyrdom played in encouraging the growth of the Jesus movement. We left off our discussion in the year 313, with Emperor Constantine issuing the Edict of Milan, which essentially put Christianity on an equal legal footing with Roman paganism and, in short order, changed the nature of the Christian Church from a movement that existed outside the official power structure of Rome to one that became quickly and intimately linked to political power. Rod agreed to come back to our program to discuss in further detail the events that followed, and so today we will be talking about the path of Christianity from the Edict of Milan through the so-called Dark Ages of medieval Europe and up to the Protestant Reformation. As noted in our earlier podcast, Rod is the author of numerous books on religion, including The Victory of Reason, How Christianity Led to Freedom, Capitalism, and Western Success, One True God, The Historical Consequences of Monotheism, and Discovering God, The Origins of the Great Religions and the Evolution of Belief. As usual, we will link to these and other books by Professor Stark, as well as his two previous appearances on our podcast. And while you're visiting our website to track down these great resources, please click on our various social media links to share this free educational program with your friends, neighbors, and congregants. Our archive is now close to 100 episodes. That's a lot of learning. Rod, welcome back to Research on Religion.
I'm delighted to be with you.
Hey, let's start off with where we left off, and that was with the Edict of Milan. One thing that I've always been curious about is how this declaration came about, particularly since it followed shortly after one of the most severe persecutions of Christianity by the emperors Diocletian and Galerius, largely prompted by the latter Galerius. What is happening in the Roman Empire and or with Emperor Constantine that prompts this change in policy, ending persecutions and putting Christianity on an equal footing with paganism?
Well, for one thing, Galerius, at the end of his life, withdrew all of his edicts against Christianity. So the persecutions were, in fact, over. As a matter of fact, Galerius, on his deathbed, asked the Christians to pray for him, and many of them probably did. So this is indicative of something else, I think, that keeps being neglected by historians, which is, given the rate, the probable rate of Christian conversion up to this point in population growth, they probably were the majority in the city of Rome and probably in most of the other leading Roman cities. This was an enormous political factor that's been overlooked, and I think that Constantine was fully aware of the fact that that Christianity was potentially a great ally as he moved to take over the empire.
Yeah, I think, too, we talked about on our last program that not only is it just the sheer numbers of Christians that were in Rome or in the Roman Empire at this period of time, but the socioeconomic characteristic was that a number of wealthier middle class, upper middle class individuals were converting to Christianity, and this more than likely included military officials and possibly even political figures.
Yeah, well, I mean, as early as probably the year 50, there were already Christians in the imperial household. So here we are, you know, several centuries later. And yes, Christians were everywhere, and and many of them were extremely prominent and powerful. And all of this was registering. And the Christians in Rome, for example, greatly welcomed Constantine when he came because they knew several things about him. One is that he had ended the persecution or prevented it in the part of the empire that he controlled, and that his mother had been a Christian of long standing. These things were probably well known to the Christians in Rome, and certainly they did support Constantine.
Now, a lot is made about Constantine's conversion to Christianity. You just mentioned a minute ago that his mother was Christian, so, you know, probably raised in a household that has some Christian influences, although one would wonder if he was raised directly by his mother or by some other official. I'm not really sure how things were done in Rome at that time. But we get pictures of the famous Constantine conversion. He's a beam of light coming down and coming across him. There's some historical debate to what extent his conversion was genuine or not. What are your thoughts on that, and does it really matter?
The anti-Christian, or actually anti-Christian, but they were a little bit subtle about it, historians, starting with people like Voltaire, of course, have denied Constantine's conversion, that it was purely an act of political expediency, and that it wasn't real. And the primary proof they like to use is that he put off baptism until very, very close to the end of his life. It doesn't wash. His behavior was clearly that of a man who was doing everything to push the fortunes of Christianity. And secondly, there were many people at this time, including some saints, who put off their baptism till late in life, because if you think about it theologically, it made a lot of sense. That is, the belief was that baptism wiped out all previous sins. It was complete atonement for everything that had gone before. And if you put that off until very late in your life, it meant that when you died, you had a relatively small number of unatoned sins that you were going to have to spend time in purgatory over, versus somebody who had a long life as a Christian and had a whole bunch of unatoned sins piled up to be paid for. I mean, it was a very clever maneuver, if you will, to reduce your time in purgatory.
Yeah, that's true. Even going back to the time of John the Baptist, you're talking about baptisms that are occurring relatively late in people's lives. And, you know, by that, we maybe mean 20 or 30 years old, but when the life expectancy was about 35 or 40. Now, one would initially think that some of the legal changes brought about by this Edict of Milan would have been a blessing for Christianity, since it helps to end the persecutions, and Galerius had done that previously, but it also allows the church to operate more in the open. Constantine also, as you mentioned, wants to contribute to the furtherance of Christianity. So, you know, he chipped in financially to help support the building of a number of churches from which to propagate Christianity. You know, and to a great extent, you look at these and you say, hey, those are positives for Christianity.
Right. Well, he was an incredible church builder.
Yeah, how so?
Oh, he built them everywhere, particularly in the Holy Land.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, big churches. He modeled them on the imperial throne halls, as a matter of fact. So, yeah, you're quite right about these aspects of doing good for the church, but there's a dark side to it.
Yeah, I want to talk about that, because you refer to this era as a mixed blessing, and other folks, including myself, have referred to it as Constantine's curse. So what is the downside of the Edict of Milan?
Well, the main downside was that because suddenly to be a bishop, let's say, in the church, put you on a par with the great grandees of the empire. I mean, suddenly, with all these blessings of money, if you will, being showered on the church, as well as all kinds of privilege, exemption from taxes, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, it suddenly became an extremely valuable position, not just a bishop, but even at the level of being a parish priest. The result was, of course, a stampede into the priesthood. by the sons of privilege. So suddenly you have a situation where people are becoming bishops who've never even been baptized yet. The church suddenly had to pass rules that you had to be baptized before you could be a bishop, and then that you had to actually be ordained before you could become a bishop, although these rules were, in fact, ignored a great deal of the time. But what happened is you were recruiting people because of their ambitions rather than because of their commitment to religion.
Mm-hmm.
And you changed from a very dedicated, very pious clergy to a very elitist, perhaps not all that devout clergy. And the church paid the price for that for the next, millennium and a half.
Mm-hmm. You refer to this as the Church of Power
right.
in relation to the Church of Piety. And I want to talk about the Church of Piety a little bit later on here. But what do you mean by that term, Church of Power?
Well, these were the people who held all the powerful positions in the church.
Mm-hmm.
Bishops, cardinals, popes. You got into a long string. You eventually soon created families in which the occupation was the church. There were bishops, cardinals, and popes ran in families. And there were a few great Roman families who basically controlled the church. And in doing so, they set policies and ran things. They couldn't run it into the ground, however, for one saving factor, and that's the Church of Piety, as you said you'd like to talk about later. But there remained in the church a very committed group of real Christians who couldn't be overcome.
Mm-hmm. And I do want to talk about the Church of Piety later. I want to bring that up when we get more into the medieval section. We're still now here in the 4th century. And one of the things that comes quickly on the heels of the Edict of Milan is the First Council of Nicaea. And this seems to be, at least to me, at least my reading of it, an indication that the Church of Power needs to clamp down on dissent and come up with a very specific definition of what the church is and what the church isn't, because it needs to enforce authority. Tell us a little bit about the Council of Nicaea.
Yeah, well, I'm not so sure that the church needed to have all that much authority. I think that the people in these positions who were backed by Constantine wanted the authority. And of course, this was a time when people pretty much took it for granted that there were going to be people in charge and that they were basically going to make the rules. It was not a very democratic age. Even the Roman Republic at its most republican, we would consider a pretty oppressive closed regime, since, after all, the Senate was simply a bunch of rich men who inherited their positions. But that was one of the other great curses that Constantine worked on the church, which was he was determined that there be no pluralism, that there be no dissent, that there be no argument. There was going to be one true faith, and he wasn't going to tolerate any variation from it.
Mm-hmm.
And so he did the church, I think, a great deal of harm by chasing after the various Arians and Donatists and what have you.
The Donatists is a really interesting faction that one would be surprised that the church would go out and crush some respects, but other it's not. Because I mean, tell us, so who were the Donatists and why did they get the hammer of St. Augustine?
Well, the Donatists had a very simple view. During the last great persecution of Christians, and the Romans, by the way, always believed that institutions were empowered from the top, and if you could cut off the top, the group went away, which wasn't true with Christians. But they attacked the top end, the bishops, whatnot, for killing him, after all. And it was possible to avoid all of this bad treatment simply by recanting.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people did. And after it was over and all was said and done, and the bishops who hadn't recanted came back out of hiding and whatnot, they were angry about it. And they said, hey, you guys who recanted, you're not bishops anymore. And you can't, you can't get it back because you let the side down, if you will. It's like, after World War II, in Europe, everybody's running around trying to get even with the people who had collaborated with the Nazis. Well, they were trying to get even with the people who had collaborated with the Romans.
Mm-hmm. And this was the Donatists that were upset with the bishops who recanted.
Donatists said, hey, we're the only church because we didn't cave in, and you guys are out. And Rome eventually held that it was okay if you said you were sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And Donatists wouldn't have any of that. And so this big conflict broke out in North Africa, which, after all, was a much more important sector of Christianity in those days than anything going on in Rome or Italy. And they weren't having any. They were not permitting the return of these old bishops and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And Augustine decided to stamp them out. They were declared the heretics.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, they hung around for another 200 or 300 years. They didn't really get stamped out, but they did get driven. Some of them were killed, and they were driven out of power.
It does give us a whiff of what is to come between the Church of Piety and the Church of Power, right? Because the Donatists are saying, "Hey, you caved in when you should have taken a stand. You're not really right. Pious as much as you should have been." And and it's interesting. The institutional church says, no, we need these leaders here because we don't have that many bishops that have the experience to go around. So we need to keep them here. So you can see that tension.
Besides, we're only human, and these guys, so they didn't have the courage to be martyrs, but who did? That mm-hmm. was the kind of moderate view of people. And of course, this was what went on in the church for a very, very, very long time.
Yeah. Well, the other question I want to ask too about in terms of stamping out dissent is not necessarily internal dissent, but external dissent. Now, with the rise of a more centralized and bureaucratic church, you would expect the church leaders to go after the internal dissent, but one would also imagine that they would want to rid society of alternative religions such as paganism, which is still around at the time. Now, one of the interesting things I found in your new book is, in contrast with your earlier book, The Rise of Christianity, you talked about how paganism quickly collapsed in the 4th century in your earlier book, but you've changed your thinking on this topic a little bit in your current book, The Triumph of Christianity. So what do we know today about the demise of paganism in the early medieval period?
That it took a very long time, and that in northern climes of Europe, it probably never disappeared entirely at all. But interestingly enough, a church that wouldn't tolerate the Donatists, was quite tolerant of paganism.
Mm-hmm.
There were still all kinds of pagan activities going on quite openly in the 700s, 800s, 900s. It slowly died out, in large part because there were advantages to being Christians. This was particularly true of the elites, that it became pretty obvious that you were unlikely to get leading political appointments and whatnot if you weren't a Christian. And again, some of this was pretty opportunistic. The families decided, it's time for us to be Christians because there are more opportunities that way. But in any event, it's not at all clear how quickly organized paganism disappeared. And it's not at all clear that unorganized paganism ever disappeared. Certainly the commitment to magic never disappeared. That came along to haunt us very badly much later.
Now, I want to move us along here. We're talking about the 4th century and into the 5th century a little bit. And just as the Christian church finally ascends to official status in the Roman Empire, the empire itself begins its period of gradual decay, with Constantine becoming more concerned about the eastern portion of the empire. He sets up shop in Constantinople, and then there's military pressure that Rome feels from the barbarian tribes of the north. And so by the late 5th century, and some people date this as the year 476, the Roman Empire ceases to exist.
Right.
And if
I
any of our...
It was the best thing that ever happened to Western civilization.
I want you... Yeah, let's talk about that, because it's... Why would you say that the decline of the Roman Empire is the best thing that ever happened to Western civilization? Many people would argue the opposite.
Yeah, I know. They always have, and they've mourned the loss of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think the rise of the West was a very chancy thing. It didn't happen anywhere else in the world. If the West hadn't developed modernity, we would still all be living a very unmodern lives, because it didn't happen anywhere else. It was a time when China was well ahead of Europe, but when voyagers from the West finally got to China, what'd they find? Well, they found people who were farming the same way they'd been farming 3,000 years ago, and they found an elite who were more concerned to cripple little girls by binding their feet than in finding better ways to farm. It was a frozen society. Well, Rome was too. The great Greek adventure leading on to Western progress was halted during the whole Roman. I would argue that there were only two instances of real progress during that 1,000 years of Rome. One was the invention of concrete, which is a fine building material.
Mm-hmm. Still use it today.
The rise of Christianity, which the Romans tried to prevent. Other than that, I think Rome was a dead end. And consequently, despite all the crazy claims about dark ages that ensued after the fall of Rome, nonsense, it was a period of enormous change and progress. I mean, suddenly we get to the 14th century, and here's Europe way ahead of the rest of the world, but the Romans weren't. Mm-hmm. How would that happen?
Yeah, something had to happen in between there. This is interesting, because if anybody, any of our listeners who are my age, or actually anybody who was in a high school class or college history class in the 20th century, would have heard that the period from roughly 500 to 1400, 1500 was the Dark Ages. How did that reputation for that period come about?
Well, there are a bunch of scholars today running our universities who are teaching children that we can't study Western civilization because it was one of many civilizations and not a good one. Well, a bunch of equivalent of college professors such as Voltaire and Gibbon and whatnot in the 18th century wanted to make theirs the time of great, great learning and progress, and they were very hostile to religion, so they basically made it up. That suddenly, Newton and all these people had just come out of nowhere when the church was forced to let them emerge, and it was all nonsense. Not only was there enormous progress during the so-called Dark Ages, the so-called scientific revolution was in fact nothing of the sort. It was the culmination of centuries of normal scientific progress. And the stories to the contrary overlooked the fact that all of the people, with one guy left out, Halley, all of the important people like Newton and whatnot were extremely pious Christians. Newton wrote more theology than he did physics.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all neglected. And the fact is, of course, that Europe made its great leap ahead during the so-called Dark Ages. I mean, it's just one thing after another.
It's a great argument that you make, and I buy into this, and it's one that I try to teach my students about, and they're oftentimes very resistant because I think today in our contemporary culture, we see such a tension between religion and science. But if you dig back in European history, you actually see that Christianity was instrumental in the creation of the scientific method and the propagation of science.
Well, without Christianity, there wouldn't have been science. The Romans weren't scientists. In order to have science, you had to have a very important ingredient. You had to believe in an orderly universe, in a universe that ran according to rules that could be discovered. You know, and everybody else said, hey, the universe is a great big accident, and what happens, happens. It's inexplicable. Chinese philosophers would have told you that it's idiotic to think that you could discover any rules governing the universe, because there aren't any. Well, the Christian notion of a rational God who created a rational world was the basic assumption that made the search for the scientific rules plausible. That's why they thought they could do it.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, one of the great, I suppose, the scientific test of the notion of a creation of a rational universe is that they went and looked for the rules and they could find them. I mean, suddenly we had all kinds of rules that seemed to work, like Newtonian mechanics and so on. We had an astronomy that no longer was having the planets have loops in their orbits.
Mm-hmm.
A lot went on. But without the assumption that the rules were there, and that depended on the notion of them having been created, you wouldn't have had any science.
Now, one of the great innovations of Christianity during this period of time is something known as scholasticism. What is that, and why was it different than how learning was occurring prior to that?
Because it was the search for knowledge rather than the search for wisdom or the search for, you know, you name it. The scholastics started universities, the higher learning, and the whole point was to gather knowledge. Basically, the whole point was science, if you will, science and engineering, and empiricism. I mean, nowhere in the world did they study anatomy by cutting up actual human cadavers, although they started doing that in these scholastic universities in the 13th century. These were the kinds of things that carried everything forward. And, of course, these schools had been started by the church. Universities were invented by the church. And these early scholars, you know, it's amazing when you read about them is how modern it feels.
Mm-hmm.
People were invited from one university to a better university on the basis of what they had done. Scholars were well known all over Europe on the basis of what they had written and what they'd discovered. And we're talking about things going on in the 12th, 13th century, not things going on in the 19th or 18th centuries. The University of Paris, you know, and these weren't little put on places with, you know, 200 students and 10 faculty. There were thousands of students at places like the University of Paris. And like today, most of the students wrote home for money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
We have a lot of the letters.
One, which is true. Now that I kind of reflect back to on what was going on in scholastic period as well as what's going on today, one of the things that impressed me about scholasticism was that it actually brought debate into the classroom, that there was this interchange between different professors and different faculty, whereas prior to that, learning was, you know, somebody wrote something 100 years ago and we're just going to recopy it because we don't have Xerox machines yet.
Right.
And you know, that becomes the thing. And sometimes when I'm sitting in lecture, I'm wondering if I'm still implementing the way that knowledge was propagated in the Roman Empire instead of the debate format. I don't know.
Well, one thing about the medieval professors, when in a jam, you could get away with reading books to them.
Yeah.
Because there was a shortage of books, and you could dictate them to your students. And that sure could take lecture time.
Yeah, that's true. They didn't have laptops to watch Facebook something. Yeah. Yeah, let me ask you the one big challenge that comes up when we talk about religion and science, and my students always bring this up. They say, what about Galileo? Isn't Galileo proof that the Vatican was very anti-science? Here he comes up with this idea that the sun is at the center of the universe instead of the earth, and the Pope comes down and clamps down on him. What's the story with Galileo?
Well, it's a little bit complicated, but the problem with Galileo got himself in trouble because he was such an egotist. I mean, of course, you know, he didn't come up with the notion the sun was in the middle. He inherited that. He claimed, by the way, he claimed a lot of things that he hadn't done. He never dropped two balls from the Tower of Pisa. He did not invent the telescope, as he claimed, and a lot of things like that. But the Pope, under whom he so-called suffered, had been his good buddy to the extent that one of his early books he dedicated to this guy long before he was Pope. And you know, the future Pope loved his provocative attacks on other church scholars and whatnot. And it was a good relationship. The Reformation had happened, and the questions were flying back and forth. The Catholic Church was being attacked for not being biblical, okay? And that was a nasty charge, and they got very sensitive about it. And, of course, the Bible does imply that, you know, the world was made in 7 days and the sun, the earth in the middle and whatnot. And so they were getting a little leery of various scientific claims, but they had an out that almost everyone except Galileo easily took. And the Pope even reminded him of it, which is all you have to do is say that this is theory, that this is mathematics, and it may or may not be true, you see. And then you just go ahead and write your book. You don't worry about it. Well, instead of doing that, when he wrote his next big book, the one that got him in trouble, you know, it was in the form of a dialogue, and he had a guy in there, Simplicius, you know, I mean, Dumbo.
Mm-hmm.
And he had this explanation that the Pope had given him to justify his book, come out of the mouth of Simplicius, and make the, you know, make fun of the whole thing. And the Pope, I think, rightfully took this as a real stab in the back. And so they called him in, called him on the carpet on it. And it really wasn't because he was claiming all these things and the church knew better. It was because he was claiming that these were true and the Bible was false and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if he didn't leave the church, he could have. Venice invited him to come and take shelter, but he didn't do it. Despite his ego, I mean, he remained a faithful Catholic. And, of course, you know, despite all the claims that the Inquisition put him in the dungeon and whatnot, he was never in a dungeon. He had a very, very comfortable and privileged house arrest.
Yeah.
And, you know, sure, it was unfortunate, but you know, it was a time and a place that where many of the concerns were different from now, and it doesn't really make the church look that bad. I mean, there are all kinds of other people who were doing science at the same time. They didn't get in any trouble. Galileo thought he was too big to be touched, I guess, or his ego was too big to be dunked or whatever, but it's not a nice story on either side.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. Now, we just talked about scientific progress here. One of the other claims that you make in the book, which I find utterly fascinating, is that there was also moral progress during the quote-unquote Dark Ages, which, as you're telling us, is really not so dark. What was this moral progress about?
Well, there were many aspects to it, but probably the most stunning and important and lasting one is they got rid of slavery. Now, yes, it came back in the New World later. And the Pope, by the way, the Pope vigorously tried to end that. They didn't have the power to do it. But in medieval Europe, by the 10th century, slavery was gone. And it was gone because the Church opposed it. And it was a theological development. They first started out with the whole question of what does it mean to be human? And what does it mean to have free will? And what does it mean to have choice? And the next thing you know, they'd worked out that really it was against the whole notion of individual responsibility for sin and whatnot to hold anyone in bondage. That was intruding on their freedom and their humanity and what. I mean, this stuff really went on. They really debated it. And they came to a conclusion that slavery is absolutely wrong, and they got rid of it.
And that was important economically for Europe, because now you had paid labor, or you had serfdom, but again, this eventually paves the way for wage labor, and although the conditions weren't all that great back then, it does lead to the dispersion of wealth, it does lead to the accumulation of capital, which... Play this out over a couple hundred years, and even though you start behind of some of the other great civilizations around the world, you're running faster now after a millennium.
Yes, and another thing is the Black Death greatly accelerated the whole thing,
mm-hmm.
because there was a huge labor shortage following, half of the world's population died in a period of 4 years. Well, afterwards, there was a lot of open land for the surviving landlords to take over, and then they turned around and they didn't have anybody to farm it.
Mm-hmm.
And over a period of 4 or 5 months, the daily wage for a plowman quadrupled. Well, that's a big change. And they even tried to pass laws against, these new wages, but everybody connived at their violation because they simply wanted labor. And that was the complete end of serfdom. Everything became hired wages because able-bodied people had the leverage. But had there still been slavery, that would have been quite different. Because,
yeah.
You're not going to raise slave wages.
Right. Let me move us along here, and we were just talking about a lot of the technological scientific progress and universities, and this really relates to the high culture, so to speak, but now I don't want to imply here that the lower classes weren't finding ways of improving their living standards, because a lot of the innovations that we oftentimes don't think of come from, people working on the farm just trying to make it easier for them to plow the fields or something, but we were talking about intellectual progress among the elite. One of your chapters in the book that I found to be rather interesting, it deals with another myth about the commoner population at this time. The medieval period is often considered to be the age of faith. And with that moniker, it implies that every commoner, every peasant, every serf was running around praising Jesus with the enthusiasm of a born-again evangelical. But this really wasn't the case. The general population wasn't really all that religious as we were led to believe.
They were religious, but not Christian.
They were, explain that. I was going to say, explain what you meant that they were religious but not Christian.
Well, an Icelandic person at the time, I suppose about the 13th century, the Torvald believes in Jesus except in matters of urgency and seafaring, in which he turns to Thor. Well, we don't really have a Christian there. But we do have a religious person there.
Mm-hmm.
But the large reason for the... Look, nobody went to church. There's immense amount of evidence of that. But one doesn't even need evidence if one realizes in 13th, 14th centuries, there weren't any churches in rural areas, and everybody lived in a rural area.
Yep.
At least 90% of the population was rural. And the only churches out there were the very small chapels of the nobility. Some of them have been measured. People are marvelous. We know that the average size was about the size of a modern living room, right? Mm-hmm. Well, you couldn't get a lot of people in there. And, of course, if the count and his wife and et cetera were there, they weren't going to let a whole bunch of peasants come in. Actually, they weren't going to let any peasants come in. There was no place to go to church. And there weren't any priests. And the priests that there were ignoramuses who had never been trained. They'd not gone to seminary. As late as, you know, we're getting into the 15, 1600s, we've got bishops going out and, in some cases, polling their parish priests on things like who preached the Sermon on the Mount, and finding out that 80% of them don't know who preached the Sermon on the Mount.
Mm-hmm.
Let alone they don't know what the Sermon on the Mount was or says. You could take a bunch of priests and ask them for the Ten Commandments, and they couldn't get but two or three of them. In that situation, how are you going to have this really religious Christian population? And the fact is, you didn't have it. And the notion, and people say, well, look at those great cathedrals. How could they have been built if the people hadn't been pious? I mean, why would they give the money to... And I've responded to people who say that by saying, look at those great castles all over Europe. The people must have loved the nobility. Otherwise, how would you gotten them built?
Mm-hmm.
And these same people say, well, you know, they were gouged out of them. You know, they... Right, and so were the cathedrals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, if one got gouged, so did the other. But the fact of the matter is, you have constant letters coming from bishops and whatnot saying, what has happened to the altar railing and the baptismal fountain cathedral, whatever, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Wherever you put them, get them back in there, and you stop having all these livestock shows and sales and whatnot going on in the cathedral. And these are constant complaints, because they were basically using them like you would use one of our domed stadiums.
Right, right.
You know, for trade shows and whatnot. Well, you know, that speaks to a rather lack of sacred use. And the fact is that, that people didn't go to church. I mean, there's constant testimony. Come the Lutheran times, we've got all kinds of reports, because Luther really tried to get people to go to church. And so they spent all these inspectors around, and they're always coming back and saying, nobody's coming to church. And when they do come, they misbehave so much, it's not clear that we want them there.
Yeah. That finding is really important, because, you know, a lot of 19th century and 20th century sociology that has really permeated a lot of the other social sciences and the way we think about religion today is based upon the notion of secularization theory. And secularization theory is based upon the notion that religion is going away, meaning that at some point in time it was flourishing. People were going to church all over the place, right. And now people are not. Well, here's the thing, is that if, you know, 400, 500, 700 years ago, nobody was going to church, actually there might be more people going to church today than there were back then.
Well, certainly it's the case in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
In 1776, only about 17% of Americans belonged to a local church congregation. At that same time, somebody has calculated that more than a third of all first birth occurred less than 9 months after marriage. And so one can conclude that the colonial female women were more likely to be engaging in premarital sex than they were in going to church.
Uh-huh.
I think that puts things in a different perspective. The marvelous thing about America is, with all the competition among denominations, is that people got churched. As a matter of fact, the percentage of Americans who belong to a local congregation, this is based on the 2007 Baylor National Survey, we calculate that number at 70%. That's the all-time high for the United States. 1850, it was 50%. So, 30%. It was not 50% till about 1920.
Yeah. Well, that's a surprising thing. I want to get back to the United States perhaps in a later interview, but I want to return back to the medieval time, because we're just talking now about these corrupt bishops, priests that didn't know anything about the Bible and probably muttered in Latin. They didn't know what they were saying, but it looked good in front of the parish folks.
There were some of them who literally muttered nonsense.
And
why not? They never had an education. They didn't know any Latin.
Yeah. Well, you know, this sets up something that's difficult to square with all the positive factors that the church helped to promote that we were talking a little bit about earlier. You see, the church is kind of corrupt in one aspect, but on the other hand, it's not. The Church of Power, it encouraged a lot of these rogues and scalawags and ne'er-do-wells to become bishops and all that. But even though that there was this degenerate influence within the church at the time, there was something else that you talk about called the Church of Piety. And this was a constant struggle, almost from the get-go of Christianity, that there was those who struggled against the corruption within the church, and this continued through the medieval period. Tell us a little bit about the Church of Piety and how that helped to shape Christianity.
Well, the fact is that there were still a lot of very religious people in Europe, despite the Constantine influx of opportunists. And this was all based in the monastic movement, which started at about the same time and always remained very, very strong. And they had a secret weapon, if you will, which is the monastics were dominated by the sons and daughters of the nobility. I did a little study of ascetic Catholic medieval saints, and 80% of them were from the nobility, 25% of them were from royalty. And they often were in a monastery or a convent that were only a few miles from home. And they continued to see their parents, and they continued, therefore, to be a close tie between this really group of pious Christians and the nobility. And that meant that, of course, the Church of Power was limited in its power. It could never get rid of the Church of Piety, even if it wanted to, and it isn't at all clear that mostly that, I mean, you know, most of the people in the Church of Power were decent people. They were worldly, but they were decent people.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, some of them, quite in awe of various ascetic saints and whatnot. So there was that kind of exchange. And from time to time, the Church of Piety gained power. In the 1000s, there was well into the 1100s, there was a whole string of popes who were monks. As a matter of fact, the Crusades began under a pope who had been a monk. And there was quite a reformation that went on. Now it deteriorated again later. You know, let me put it this way. You know, what finally came out of all this? And that is, I think, the greatest impact that the Reformation had on Christianity, or one of the greatest factors, was the complete reform of the Roman Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
It put the Church of Piety in power, and it stayed in power ever after, with the consequence that you soon had a highly educated clergy, no more muttering and pretending you were speaking Latin. The clergy could speak Latin, and they were pretty well educated and well trained, and the church actually, you know, one of the things that misleads us so much, you know, kind of imagining the medieval church on the basis of the current church, which is false. The medieval church wasn't anything like the current church. Current church is the Church of Piety. It's a very strong organization, and it's fundamentally one based on real religiousness.
Now, you just mentioned the Reformation there. When we say the Reformation, we usually consider it the Protestant Reformation, but you make an argument in The Triumph of Christianity, which also goes back to one of my favorite books of yours, For the Glory of God, about reformations in the church to begin with. And this really reflects the constant battle between the Church of Piety and the Church of Power. And as you mentioned, in the 1000s, there were reformations that occurred that were contained within the church. And so tell us a little bit about that ongoing struggle between the Church of Piety and what it means to have a Reformation as compared to the Protestant Reformation, which you argue is not necessarily a Reformation, but a schism.
Yeah, although it must admit that that Luther initially did not intend to leave the church, did not intend to break away. He really believed that the church could be reformed. He was part of, after all, he was a monk. He was part of the Church of Piety. And he was offended by some of the goings on of the Church of Power, particularly some of their fundraising methods. But he was driven out of the Catholic Church rather than that he left it.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing is that in response to all of these attacks that Luther and then, of course, Calvin and all of these people were aiming at Rome, was that the Church of Piety got control, put in enormous number of reforms, and made them stick. And it changed the religious world even vastly more dramatically than what Protestantism achieved in its own right.
Yeah, it's often referred to as the Counter-Reformation, but the Counter-Reformation was really the Reformation within the Catholic Church, which is kind of the one of the big ironies of all of that. And again, too, we think of Luther as being the first reformer, but you know, your book makes amply clear that the monasteries, the monastic movements were really these reform movements. They were small reform movements that were contained within the Catholic Church, but it just so happened in the early 1500s, one guy got kicked out and that changed the course of Christian history.
Well, you know, the funny thing is the Crusades played a big part in all of this, because when the Pope got a bunch of guys to go out and preach the Crusades, they all were preaching church reform as well. And as time passed, they became more and more devoted to preaching church reform. Which, by the way, you see these monk popes around the time of the Crusades were themselves had been pushing hard to reform the church.
Mm-hmm.
To get rid of the purchase of offices, for example, and things like that. And the odd thing is that these reform movements that got going during the Crusade preaching led to some of these early heretical movements that that led to all of those religious wars long before you know Luther's born, you know, centuries. So that whole thing got started then, and eventually had huge results.
One thing that I want to address before we finish up here, because we're running short on time, is another myth that you brought up. And this, I love this chapter because this was something new that you that's in this book that's really exciting for me. And that was the issue of the Spanish Inquisition and the myth of the Spanish Inquisition. What is the myth of the Spanish Inquisition, and why was it a myth?
Well, now historians agree there is simply an enormous hoax produced on history that was called the Black Legend. And it stems from the wars between Spain and England. And the English began portraying the Spaniards as cruel and vicious and crazy and Catholic and etc. And the historians bought into it. And consequently, enormous amounts of Spanish history was misrepresented, and perhaps nothing more so than the Inquisition. Let me say this for the Inquisition. The witch hunts never happened in Spain and Italy, and they didn't happen because the Inquisition didn't let them happen. Now, the Inquisition did have a few people hanged in relation to witchcraft, but not for being witches, but for having burned witches. There's a very big difference. We know now an enormous amount about the Inquisition and see that it was largely a force for moderation and legality. And we know that because a few years ago, scholars were given access to 41,000 cases that were heard by the Inquisition and were recorded in great detail, often, verbatim transcripts of testimony. And this is just a gigantic pile of stuff. And the people who studied it, many of them are not Spanish, not Catholic, but they were good social scientists, and they've put it up on computer records. And we've been able to analyze it. And it was very, very seldom that anyone was sent to the state for execution. It was amazing how rational the whole thing was. The reason that the Inquisition, by the way, was so good on witchcraft is because in the very early trial, they listened to the people being tried and discovered, see, what the witches really were doing something. What they were doing is magic. Well, there was church magic and non-church magic. In church magic, you got a church. Non-magic was kind of illegal most places, and you got in trouble for it. But when the Spanish Inquisition court started listening to some of these people turned in for witchcraft, they discovered that the people had no intention of sinning. And so they came up with the idea of unintentionally invoking wicked spirits. And you can't really get after people for that because it was unintentional. So all they'd make them do was say five Hail Marys and go home.
Yeah, yeah.
And it made a huge difference. And then they'd send people out to investigate episodes. They come back and say, there wasn't any witchcraft that I could discover out there, but there wasn't a lot of talk about it. And eventually they convinced the rest of Europe that it was all a hoax and a nightmare.
Well, I think we're going to have to leave off with that because we are out of time, but I want to tell our listeners that the book, The Triumph of Christianity, is a lot richer. There's a lot of topics we haven't covered here in terms of medieval Europe, so I recommend that everybody pick it up. And we still have only made it through about two-thirds of the book, so I'm going to have to ask you for another visit to come back and talk to us about what happens after the Protestant Reformation and specifically with religious pluralism in the United States. Are you willing to do that?
Certainly.
Well, Rod, it has been an absolute pleasure, as always, to have you on. So thanks for being on Research on Religion.
I really enjoyed it. Bye now.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.